Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com. Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. Thank you for joining us. We're going to be talking today about childhood cancers and their treatment. And while that may seem certainly and is a grim topic, there is a great deal of hope as we've seen tremendous progress in the treatment of childhood cancers in the United States and around the world. Cancer is diagnosed each year in about 400,000 children and adolescents worldwide. And cancer is the leading cause of death by disease in the United States children once they're part of the past infancy. However, thanks to better therapies, more than 80% of U.S. childhood cancer patients now become long-term survivors, and there are 483,000 childhood cancer survivors in the United States, and that is a much higher percentage than in adult cancer. We are fortunate to have two guests today, both at the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm going to introduce them in a moment, but I want to talk to you for a moment about St. Jude's itself. Many of you may have heard of St. Jude, particularly in connection with the entertainer Danny Thomas, who was instrumental in its founding, and his daughter Marlo Thomas has continued his work. More than 70 years ago, Danny Thomas had apparently reached a point in his life where he was despairing, and he turned to St. Jude Thaddeus, the patron saint of hopeless causes, and prayed, "Show me my way in life, and I will build you a shrine." He kept that vow. And in 1962, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital opened in Memphis, Tennessee. Since then, it has led the way in treatment of children's cancers, especially leukemias, and also in sickle cell disease. One of its researchers, Dr. Peter Daugherty, was awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1996. And more recently, in 1999, St. Jude announced a cure for the immune disease commonly known as bubble boy disease. And there is more. St. Jude became the first fully racially integrated children's hospital in the South when segregation was still a major concern. St. Jude also relies predominantly on donations and research grants for financial support. Unique among children's hospitals, families never receive a bill from St. Jude for treatment, travel, housing, or food. St. Jude's motto is that it won't stop until no child dies from cancer. So with that, let me introduce you to our two guests who are pediatric oncologists at St. Jude. Dr. Jamie Fleurlage is graduated from Union College with both bachelor's and master's degree. She was also co-captain of the women's hockey team there. She got her MD from Albany Medical College and did her pediatric residency and was chief resident at Johns Hopkins Children's Center. She did her oncology fellowship at the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Dr. Amy Taller got her undergraduate degree also at Union College. She did her got her MD from the University of New York Medical University in Syracuse, New York, did her residency in pediatrics at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and her fellowship in pediatric hematology and oncology at St. Jude, and also did further fellowship training in bone marrow transplant therapy. Thank you both for being here. So we want to talk a little bit – we're going to talk a little bit about St. Jude and further about what makes that special, but we also obviously are going to be talking about childhood cancers. tell us, if you could each tell me why, what led you to go into pediatric oncology?
Sure. This is Jamie, and it's thanks for having us. I'm happy to share with you. And as you mentioned, St. Jude is a really special place, and Amy and I both found our way here. Our paths were very similar. We started actually at the same college, so we've known each other a really long time. But everybody has their very usually specific reason for going into pediatric oncology, because it's always felt more like a calling than just a job. And I, growing up, had friends and actually a classmate who died of leukemia when I was in sixth grade. And that was really impactful. And that was my first experience with leukemia. And then as I moved through life, I lost a grandfather to lung cancer. And his oncologist was amazing. We have a huge family. It was super complicated. And just the way in which he managed my grandfather's medical piece and looking at him as a whole person, I knew that it's something I wanted to emulate. And so I'd always loved medicine. And after that experience, losing my grandfather is actually what made me want to be an oncologist. Kids are my soul, and they are what motivate me. And so kids with cancer was an easy calling for me really early in life.
And Dr. Teller?
Yeah, so I'm happy to add on that. I mean, I echo a lot of what was just said. I think for me, I didn't always know that I wanted to be in pediatric cancer care. It was something that as I went through my training, I had more exposure to and realized that it was my passion. And so initially I thought I was going to be a general pediatrician. And this was really based on my own childhood experiences with my family physician, kind of my natural love of science and kind of how that links to medicine and then of kids. But then as I was exposed to all the possibilities of subspecialty care and pediatrics, my hem-onc rotation and residency quickly drew me in, and I realized that this is my place. And I loved it for a lot of reasons, primarily the patients and the families, and really, as Dr. Falagi just said, being a part of their journey through a really extraordinary time that these patients and families are going to. And I wanted to be a part of that, to be able to help them in any way that I could. And then really the medical aspects of their underlying diseases and the continued challenges we have to improve response rates and minimize side effects. So there was a potential for both an impact on an individual level as well as a larger societal level. And then bone marrow transplant and cell therapy is an even subspecialty within PEDS HemOnc, and that really struck a chord with me as I saw how these treatment approaches are different than kind of traditional chemotherapies. Which was very fascinating for me, and again, had a lot of opportunity to continue to grow the field.
Well, thank you both for sharing that. Let's talk about childhood cancer. You know, 40, 50 years ago, when a child got cancer, it was a death sentence, and almost any kind of cancer, and particularly the leukemias. A lot has changed since then, but can you talk about the fundamental differences between childhood and adult cancers? For example, in leukemia, is it the same disease or is it in some ways a different disease than adult leukemia?
Yeah, this is Jamie. So great question, because I think this is really interesting in that at the field as a whole, some are similar and some are very different. So as we look across the entire age spectrum, there are certain types of cancer that only happen at a younger age, sort of less than 18 in our classic pediatric group, or older and later in life. And some has to do with genetic factors and things that you might be born with where cancer shows up earlier. Some later in life are more exposure-based, anything from smoking to radiation, et cetera. So that sometimes makes a difference as well. And some are very, very similar. So I am primarily a lymphoma physician, and a lot of the things that we see in our pediatric population are the exact same that people see again later in life. So there's a peak in childhood, sort of between the age of 15 and 39, which we call our AYA, or adolescent and young adult. But this exact same disease actually happens again with high prevalence over the age of 55. So actually for each disease, it's pretty specific and different. So some are the exact same and actually can be treated the exact same, and some are very different. And so for each disease, as you look across the age spectrum, some are same and some are very, very different.
Talk to us a little bit about Hodgkin's lymphoma. That's a disease you're right, it's bimodal. It occurs later in life, but people often associate this with younger people. What is Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Yeah, so Hodgkin lymphoma is a cancer of the lymph nodes. And so you should have normal lymph nodes that grow in response to fighting off a virus. For instance, right now in the era of COVID, they can get bigger. Sometimes they're tender and you feel it. But then after you have a virus or something trigger your lymph nodes to grow and fight something off, they should go away. And so often what happens is in somebody's lymph node, it makes an abnormal cell. And really any abnormal cell, it can be a cancer cell. We all clear abnormal cells on a regular basis because our immune system clears them, and then we don't develop cancer. But usually in this phase where some process or virus stimulated your lymph nodes, one of the cells that's atypical is not cleared. And the classic Hodgkin-Reed-Sternberg cell is just this cell that skips, it has a couple things that change that allows it to skip through the immune system, and it doesn't recognize it, and it stays. Then it circulates through your lymph nodes because they're all connected, so it circulates around your body, and then those cells continue to grow. The adolescent population, so I'm primarily an adolescent teenage provider, and that is one of the most common peaks. So lymphoma is actually the number one cancer type in adolescents. But the same type of disease is seen again later in life. And honestly, it's sort of poor luck. There's not a lot of genetic factors that we've shown that cause the formation of Hodgkin's. It's not something necessarily somebody was born with. It's more exposure to viruses, and somebody's immune system just missed it. And once you clear the cells again, they can go on to have a healthy and productive life.
What are the ways in which a young person might present in terms of symptoms, which would be concerning to probably their primary care pediatrician and then ultimately to the hematologist?
Most people come in with enlarging lymph nodes, usually in their neck, the front of their neck, and right above their collarbone. And those lymph nodes have been there on average of 3 months or more, and they just keep growing. They're usually painless. They don't hurt. They're not tender. They don't have a cough or a cold or another reason to have them. And what they usually say is sometimes they have fevers for no reason. They have sweating at night where they're drenching the sheets in bed for no reason, and they're losing weight for no reason without trying. And those are the common symptoms. It's a slow-growing process, so it didn't happen overnight. It's usually been there at least 3 to 6 months, as I mentioned. So this is not a lymph node that came up literally since yesterday. And you have a little time to figure it out, but that's the common presenting. So they feel a lymph node that's been growing over a couple months.
And what are the treatments for Hodgkin's lymphoma, and how has that changed over the years?
Yeah, it's interesting. The treatment is really, to me, fascinating. And going back just to share, you know, you mentioned that there are over almost 480,000 childhood cancer survivors. But Hodgkin is a good example of, from the start, it's actually been curable. But just curing a patient isn't good enough. So if they are 10, they have hopefully a long lifespan left. So we need to cure them with quality later. And what I mean by that is not a lot of late effects that affect them. So it's not enough to cure them. We need to cure them and let them have a healthy life. So the first cure for Hodgkin was radiation therapy. It works super well, but there's a lot of side effects that can come later in life, including a second cancer at the spot that you are radiating. And so while we were curing people even early on with a cure rate of about 85% when most cancers weren't curable, they were then dying later of a second cancer. And so, again, just that those stats sometimes of curing is not enough. We need to cure them and have them lead a healthy life. So over time, we've learned that you can give low-dose chemotherapy and then only radiate smaller and smaller fields over time, meaning instead of radiating a mass that might be the size of an orange or more, we're down to radiating pieces that are like the size of a marble. And some patients actually don't need radiation at all. So we've sort of moved into an era where we're trying to keep the cure rates the same, but to do it better with less. So it's been an interesting field over time. So in those people who are surviving of their cancer, how do we have them survive with healthy lives, without heart disease, without more cancers later in life from the thing that cured them in the first place?
You bring up a very, very important point, and we're going to talk about it during the hour, the secondary cancers that can occur later or other side effects in the treatment itself. I will tell you just a personal anecdote that one of my friends in college was a terrific wrestler, a guy named Jeff Blatnick. He was at Springfield College. When he finished his successful college wrestling career, about 2 years later, he developed Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he went through the treatments. This was back in the This would have been about 1981 or two. Next time I saw him was when I turned on television during the 1984 Olympic Games and watched him win a gold medal in the Olympics. This is just 2 years following his treatment. So it was, it was a remarkable thing to see him be able to do that.
You know what? And you mentioned with lymphoma, you know, you mentioned sort of one of St. Jude's landmark things was curing bubble boy disease. And it just speaks to the impact of how we cure and how important that is, that the cure number isn't the whole story. So Brian Sorrentino is an amazing physician who actually started that process to find that cure for bubble boy syndrome. And he died in the process of us running that trial here of lung cancer that was secondary to the radiation he received as a Hodgkin patient when he was a teenager. So one plug, just to make sure, because it didn't come out just yet, is one thing St. Jude is exceptional at is studying patients after they have cancer for the rest of their life. So we have this incredible survivorship program that when we talk about how do we cure better, it's not a guesswork. There are tons of data to see what happens to these patients 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, for the rest of their life. So we know what's happening based on the therapy we give them. And it's an incredible opportunity for us all to learn of the effects our cancer delivery and cures have for the rest of their life, and then share that with the world. And our survivorship program here is amazing.
That is so important. And certainly one would hope that a number of the pediatric oncology programs could model that. Dr. Teller, let's talk a little bit about leukemias. Again, particularly ALL, which is acute lymphoblastic leukemia, used to be a very rapid death sentence. Things have markedly changed. Can you tell us about what's happened over the decades?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, as you said, B-cell ALL is the most common childhood leukemia. And it's leukemia of one specific type of cell, your B-cell, which is why it's called B-cell ALL. And it used to be a death sentence, absolutely. And it was a combination of not having the best treatments to make the leukemia go away, but also we know our treatments have side effects, like we just talked about, both in the short term and the long term. And so we might be able to make the leukemia go away, but they were having side effects like infections that we couldn't control and other things contributing to low survival. And so over time, a lot of the progress we've made has been multifold, so including our cancer-directed treatments, new drugs, different combinations of the drugs that we already had, making sure that they are all effective but also not having additive toxicities, and so being mindful of that. But then also a lot of work and interest in how do we help these patients get through this treatment. So our supportive care aspects, working with our infectious disease colleagues, our cardiologists, our pulmonologists, really this big team to how do we manage the side effects of the chemotherapy that they're getting. And with all of that together, we've really made a lot of progress for some of these kind of upfront treatments, especially in the world of leukemia.
How does leukemia differ from lymphoma, which we were just talking about?
Yeah, so it can be very similar. So it's leukemia, depending on which subtype we're talking about, it really kind of starts in your bone marrow and affects different immune cells in your body where they just grow out of control. You can also have enlarged lymph nodes because the immune cells travel through those areas of the body as well. But you really see a large number of these cells circulating in your blood. And so you can see that you have leukemia on a simple blood test, looking at your total white count and the cells that are there. And so they're related but different. And then depending on the subtype, it's different immune cells that are involved. And that helps us think about what treatments to use, because not all treatments will be effective against all types of leukemias, and the same for lymphomas. And then also when we're thinking about kind of what our outcomes are and what we could counsel the families on of what to expect over the next few months to years of their life.
I want to let our listeners know that our phones are open. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, if you've yourself have been a patient in the past or have family members or friends who were patients as children, we're at 802-244-1777. So you also have trained particularly in bone marrow transplant. And also, by the way, I see that you were at Children's National Medical Center. I also did medical school and residency in Washington, and as part of that, spent a month at Children's, most of it on their bone marrow transplant unit. Children's National Medical Center, like St. Jude's, is a terrific place, certainly the premier Children's Hospital and for the Washington metropolitan area and a much larger surrounding catchment area. But bone marrow transplant is a particularly remarkable field. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of bone marrow transplant and how it started and what it is and how it's developed?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think kind of going back to the why someone would need a bone marrow transplant is a good place to start. So we've talked a lot about the progress we've made in being able to cure some childhood cancers, particularly ALL and leukemias. But unfortunately, even for those kind of populations where a lot can be cured, not everybody is. And so either their disease doesn't respond to the therapy like we want it to, or it comes back or relapses. And then there continue to be other subtypes of leukemia that don't have as good of response rates, thinking about things like AML or T-cell ALL. And so we think about transplant as how do we fight this cancer and help it make it go away in a different way than kind of using our traditional chemotherapies. And so what transplant does is really tries to use the power of the immune system. So your immune system is really good at kind of surveilling your body, looking for things that look different, and then mounting a response and clearing that thing. So you have a virus, the immune system responds, says, you don't belong here, I'm going to protect my host, the body, and grow in number and clear that virus. Unfortunately, when you have leukemia or a cancer, your immune system isn't doing a good job at getting rid of those abnormal cells. And so what we do for transplant is for patients in which kind of the traditional chemotherapies just weren't enough, either because their cancer grew resistance or just came back earlier than we wanted it to. The goal of this is to replace the patient's immune system with the healthy immune system of a donor. And that donor can sometimes be the sibling of a patient. It can sometimes be an unrelated donor from across the world who's joined the marrow registry. And we sometimes will also use a parent as a donor. And so these donors give us a sample of their marrow or their immune system. And we transfer that to the patient after they get some different chemotherapy, sometimes radiation, to kind of get their body ready. And these new cells kind of set up a new home in their new body. And so they replace the patient's old marrow with good, healthy cells. And they also replace the patient's immune system. And the idea of that is that that new immune system will now hopefully better protect the patient from cancer cells that might still be there or that try to come back in the future. And so you kind of transfer this immunity for this kind of long-lived surveillance to try to keep someone from having their disease come back. And over time, how we do that has changed dramatically. So just like we've gotten better at what treatments we use and how we support patients through that in the upfront setting, we also have done that in the world of transplant. And so really trying to keep our patients safe as we're doing this kind of switch of immune systems, keeping them safe from infection, monitoring for different organ toxicities that might happen to be able to help them get through, and also trying to decrease the side effects that the new immune system can cause. So unfortunately, the new immune system is good at recognizing all things that look different. So hopefully that's the leukemia or the cancer, but they can also attack the patient's normal body, something called graft versus host. The graft is the new cells, the host being the patient's normal cells.
That is, and so, you know, that is a really important part of your treatment and some of the side effects. We're going to talk about that and more after the break. So much more to cover. Please stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Dr. Lewis Myers back with the second half talking about childhood cancers and particularly the leukemias and lymphomas today with Dr. Amy Teller and Dr. Jamie Fleurlage. Dr. Teller, let me stay with you. We were talking about the leukemias and the treatment just before the break. A lot of, I think all expectant mothers now here are asked if they want to donate cord blood. Can you talk about that and why that may be important?
Yeah, absolutely. So as we're looking at potentially using someone else's healthy immune system that will recognize the leukemia as different and fight it, and that's why we do bone marrow transplant, cord blood is one source of those cells that we can use. And so it's important to think about as we're looking for donors for patients, again, sometimes there's a sibling that we can use, either a sibling that is old enough to be able to donate marrow or a cord blood that was saved from a sibling. But there's only a 1 in 4 chance that any one sibling will be a match for the patient in front of us. And so then we look to different donors. And so that's a combination of things like cord blood, so expectant mothers who have donated and families who have donated the umbilical cord after their delivery and are able to store it in a facility can potentially be used for someone in the future, as well as donors, grown-up donors, adults who have put themselves onto the National Marrow Donor Program, onto that registry to really help put their information out there in their medical history and potentially could save a life.
Yeah, let me reemphasize that because I think it's so important. Becoming a bone marrow, going on the registry is painless.
Agreed.
And it absolutely, if you're chosen as a match, that is not entirely painless, but it's minor compared to the life that you can save. So it's one of the best things you can do in the world is to go on the donor marrow registry. And I would encourage you to contact, I guess I would contact Red Cross about that.
So it's called the NMDP, or the National Marrow Donor Program. And so it's a quick Google search, and you can find out the best way. They can send you a kit. It's usually just a quick cheek swab that you can then send back. And then if in the future, if it looks like you'd be a good potential donor for a patient, either a child or an adult, they'll reach out to you and let you know what that process looks like. And you can always say no at that time or continue to explore and see if it makes sense. But I agree, and thank you for putting that plug out there. I think for a lot of patients, there's lots of donor options, but there's still quite a few patients that don't have donor options, especially those that come from kind of more diverse backgrounds and ethnic kind of collaborations across different countries. So having a very diverse donor pool is very helpful.
Let's talk about that since you brought it up, particularly any racial differences in terms of the disease itself and the cure rates. I mean, we know across the span of healthcare that there are racial disparities, and a lot of that is social based, that we're not providing adequate care for many groups. But are there basic biological differences which make it more difficult to find cure in any particular group?
Yeah, there can be. I think that the social aspect is definitely an ongoing thing that we talk about and we try to improve upon. We're also learning a lot more about the genetics of cancer and kind of what leads to a given leukemia or tumor to arise. And some of those genetic changes that we see can be enriched in certain patient populations. So there can be kind of that link back to the ethnic or racial history of a given patient.
So there's also, and this is, there's some evidence that children who have more typical, quote-unquote typical childhood infections are less likely to get leukemia and possibly lymphoma. And there's some evidence that also having, I believe, an older parent, in particular the father, may be at least a minor risk. Can you talk about either or both of those?
Yeah, this is Jamie. I'm happy to take the first one is probably the easiest. You know, it is interesting. There's a huge amount of literature and people studying sort of why does somebody develop cancer in the first place, and our exposures, how much exposure is good or bad in a young age. And one thing we know is that healthy children who are in daycare, tend to have a lower chance of developing leukemia. So when we think about leukemias in general, the more your immune system is sort of fighting off viruses and stimulated the younger you are, the more robust it is. Almost it's learned if you made any of those bad cells in the process, it's cleared them. And those patients tend to, those healthy kids, I should not say patients, my apologies, tend to not develop leukemia. And that's not true across the board for some cancers. So those who develop a brain cancer or other types that we haven't focused on so much in the call, those theories of early exposure to viruses or different gut bacteria. So the amount of dirt you ate is actually a helpful thing, not a harmful thing. So the kid who ate the dirt is less likely to develop leukemia. So we know that our microbiome, how early we are exposed to germs, does help prevent certain cancers, probably priming your immune system to be really ready and more robust at an early age. But some cancers, as I was going to mention, like a brain cancer, we haven't found those same theories to be true for all types.
That has to be reassuring to parents of dirt-eating children.
Yes, it's going to be okay, and you are revving up their immune system, and it is going to be okay.
What about the finding, or I don't know how robust the finding is, that older parents, and particularly older father, can be at least a minor risk factor?
Yeah, so that is not something as a premise that we counsel our patients on, or those who are trying to have another child at a later age in life. The rates are not that strong. Actually, the other side is the one that's a little bit different. So the older maternal age, or now advanced maternal age, it's actually younger than you'd think, more like the age of 35 and over. Every year above 35, you have an increased risk of having a child with Down syndrome. And that extra chromosome 21 copy does carry an increased chance of developing leukemias. And so that we do see, and we do have a fair number of patients with Down syndrome who develop leukemia that we treat here and all across the world.
All right. Let's go back to talking with Dr. Taller about, we started to talk about graft versus host disease, and that is a very complicated but very important part of the both the treatment and unfortunate side effects. Can you tell us what graft versus host is?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, with transplant, we're giving a patient a new immune system. But unfortunately, we're hoping that that new immune system will see any leukemia or cancer cells as different and fight that. But when we're transferring that new immune system into the patient, we're not giving it a steering wheel, if you will. And so unfortunately, those immune cells can see normal patient tissues as abnormal because it's a new immune system seeing the cell. It is different than what that immune system's used to from its prior person or prior host. And so it sometimes can attack those normal cells. And so there's a lot of different ways we can try to keep that from happening. Some things is kind of picking and choosing which cells we give to a patient from the donor, trying to decrease the risk of those cells causing harm, but also preserving their ability to do good and monitor for cancer. And there's also medicines that we give kind of in the early after transplant period to try to train those new immune cells while they're in the body to get along with their new host and to not cause any trouble. But it still is a pretty significant side effect. About a quarter of our patients have some form of graft versus host disease. It can be very mild and very treatable. It can also be pretty severe and require lots of immune suppression medicines to calm down that overactivated immune system and can cause trouble and land people in the hospital for quite some time.
My memories of my 1 month spent on the bone marrow transplant as a medical student is that it's a tremendous balancing act with, and we're talking about life and death decisions on a daily basis. These children are really sick. I mean, they're sick because we're in essence, we're making them sick with the treatments, mm-hmm. but with the hope, the real hope of a cure on the other side. But they go through a lot of difficult and painful procedures. How do you keep sort of yourself healthy in that atmosphere when you're having to deal with this much, not only illness, but sort of suffering that you're having to provide in order to get them well?
Yeah, I think it's a hard question. I think, as Jamie said earlier in the call, it really is a calling for a lot of us who are in this field. I think we do put our patients and our families through a lot. The treatments can be hard, but kids are also really remarkable. And so it's not to say that there's not suffering or there's not bad days, because there absolutely are. But I think kids are also very inspiring with how they can perk up, give you a smile, want to sing a song. And those moments of still trying to have a childhood through all of this can be very motivating to the patients or to the people who are taking care of these patients. And again, I look at my role as not only from the medical side of trying to help patients through this and survive this, but also helping patients and their families get through the moment-to-moment downsides. And so really listening to them, what do they need in addition to medical care? Is there any other support that they can do, stories about their kids that they want to share, and provide that emotional support, both from myself, but also we have a whole team of people who really try to help patients and families from all of those aspects to get through it. And so it can be hard. It can be a lot to see and to go through. But at the end of the day, I'm just inspired to come back the next day and do it all over again.
Well, we're glad you do.
Thanks. I would totally add to that. You know, kids are amazing and resilient, but one thing that keeps us going too is, and it's one of the reasons that we've both moved to Memphis and chosen to live here to work at St. Jude, is we are so blessed with resources to help these families through it. Kids tolerate chemo very well. Like, I think often people think that they're super sick, but, you know, if they're sleeping or they're awake and it's going and it doesn't hurt, they don't even know it. And so child life, art therapy, therapy dogs that are here, music therapy, there are so many things to make their days actually bright. And so although there are times that are hard for everybody, a lot of the days are actually really good days, even when they're going through a transplant or going through chemo. And that's thanks to all these other things we've learned over the many years that can actually help and make a huge difference and distract. And so while every day is a struggle because they're going on their cancer journey, they're not suffering in that deep-seated way. So one thing I wish is that everybody could come and just see this place and see where we're working today. But it's very hopeful. The atmosphere in general is very positive. It's Halloween, so I'm currently in an astronaut costume because it's space day, and that's how we roll. And you just find ways to find bright spots each day that keep it hopeful during the whole cancer experience.
I would reinforce that medicine is always a team sport. There are so many people that contribute to patient care, but I think particularly in childhood cancer, that's, as you pointed out, that's particularly the case, it sounds like, with so many different associated professionals helping. I would also add that for those who are listening, patients and families who go to St. Jude are not billed, but they get much of their money through donations. So you can help by including St. Jude or your local or other children's hospitals in your Christmas giving this year. It makes a huge difference. Let's move away from the blood cancers and a little bit. You mentioned brain cancer. Again, not a good diagnosis, but how are brain cancers in children different than brain cancers in adults?
Yeah, so I myself am not a neuro-oncologist anymore, but one thing that we've learned, which is a true premise sort of for all cancers, is, you know, saying somebody has brain cancer doesn't actually mean that much anymore because there are so many types. And in an era of precision medicine where we're able to really learn about the specific cells and the changes within those cells in that cancer patient, the field has really grown. So now if somebody has a brain tumor, it's not just what type, it's then what subtype, and what are the genetic markers for that subtype. So as a whole, some of the things we see in pediatrics are the same as in adults with unfortunate diagnosis like glioblastoma multiforme, also known as GBM, that people have seen in the press because it's just a really hard diagnosis to treat. So today, each type of tumor, including in pediatrics for brain tumors, some are easier to treat because they actually don't sort of spider web into tissues and you can cut them out, or they're less aggressive, or they're an easy type to target. So sometimes the changes within the cells actually just make the chemo work beautifully, and others show resistance no matter what you give. So whether or not it's easy to cut out, how easily it responds to cancer chemotherapy, how easy it might respond to radiation therapy, which is often part of that cure for patients with a brain tumor, and the location. Because some parts of the brain are so important, like the brainstem, that you can't cut them out because you would damage healthy tissue your body can't live without. So type, location, how they respond, and all those same premises are true across the board, even in adult tumors as well.
Another common tumor in children, which we don't really see in adults, is neuroblastomas. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So neuroblastoma in general is, you're right, something that happens primarily in a pediatric population. We call it a solid tumor. It is a solid mass. We've been talking about leukemia, so usually you don't see that in their bone marrow. And again, there's a couple subtypes when we think about neuroblastoma. And one of the interesting things that holds true for almost all cancers is how easily a patient responds upfront to therapy often shows us how well they'll do the rest of the way. So that premise is true also in neuroblastoma. Some of those patients need more aggressive therapy and some are really easily cured. But today, in general, it's a very curable cancer.
the I know I'm jumping around, but let me go back to talking about the leukemias again. There's something called CAR T cell, and this is a really can be a rather complicated concept, but it's developing, it's exciting. Tell us just very briefly about that and how it's making a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll take that one. So this is Amy. So I think CAR T cell is an example of us trying to take the immune system and use it better to fight cancers. And so we talked about kind of why transplant and that it's using the immune system, but again, it doesn't have a steering wheel. We're just transferring these new immune cells and hoping that because they look different than the leukemia or the cancer, that they'll do what we want and be able to get rid of any cells. There's a lot of different kind of immune therapies or cell therapies that are out there, including this one specific CAR T, where the goal of all of them is to make the immune system better fight cancer. And so some of these treatments are medicines that try to rev up the immune system, not really telling it what to fight, but just telling it get excited, and then they encounter something that looks different and they're more apt to get rid of it. There's medications that help the immune system see the cancer cells better. So they don't tell the immune cell to do the fighting, to do the destroying, but it kind of brings it in closer contact with the cancer cell and then, again, relies on the immune system to do its job. And then something like CAR T therapy, which is short for chimeric antigen receptor, is a way that we take immune cells, in this case T cells, that's why it's CAR T, and we change the T cells in such a way, we genetically kind of modify them so that the T cell has this new thing on its surface, this CAR, that is meant to guide it to a certain type of cancer. And so there's lots of different CAR products out there, and they're targeting different things, different flags that are on the surface of different types of leukemia. And so a common one in pediatrics is something called CD19 CAR T cell therapy. And CD19 is a flag that's on most B-cell ALL cancer cells. And so we take the T cells and in a lab can change their DNA. So they put this CAR, this receptor, on its surface, and we give these now modified T cells back to a patient. And the goal is that once these CAR T cells are back in a patient, that CAR that's on the surface will find the flag on the leukemia cell, bringing this immune cell directly to the cancer cell. And when that CAR engages with that marker, that flag, it then tells the T cell, kill what we're attached to. So it's kind of, in a way, revving up the immune system, but also guiding it to its target.
I think it's an example of precision medicine, which, if there's one fundamental difference, if I hear you, both of you, between how we treated cancers 40 or 50 years ago, pediatric cancers, and now, it's that rather than blunt force, we are increasingly using very precise methods, which hopefully have less side effects. But and an increased effectiveness. And I think that's only going to continue, particularly as we look at gene editing, such a technique such as CRISPR, which we talked about some months ago in this show. The future is really wide open in terms of, I think, what we're going to be able to do.
Absolutely, it is. And it's changing every day. It's interesting, too. You know, in the past, we knew some patients did well after a therapy and some didn't. And they all got the same therapy, and it was hard to know why. And now, as we've seen with the genetics of everybody's own cancer, so the DNA literally inside just their cancer cells, that why is starting to change and diminish. We know why. And so now we can do different things with these targeted therapies specifically for the changes in their leukemia DNA. And so everybody can do the same. So when people didn't do well in the past, we couldn't answer that question. And now because of countless hours of research and donor dollars, we can. You mentioned...
Go ahead.
Sorry, you go.
No, you go.
You mentioned one other thing. A lot of people ask, like, everybody knows somebody with cancer. Mm-hmm. What else can we do? Certainly donating to any place for cancer research and to help everybody do better and support people getting treatment. But other very low-lying things are just prompting, again, that donor registry, the bone marrow donor registry, and giving blood and platelets. So every patient we just described, in order to make it through these therapies, needs transfusions along the way. From everybody who's listening and everybody who knows somebody with cancer, you can help. And that is a huge help, and we don't state it enough. And getting a COVID vaccine. COVID, when we're pulling out the immune system from every patient getting chemotherapy, the risk of influenza and all the regular viruses are really high, let alone COVID. So there's lots people can do to help, to donate, to become a marrow donor on the registry, to give blood, and to get their vaccines, including COVID.
Absolutely. All of the listeners are part of this team.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you about parents and siblings in our remaining minutes, because often they don't get as much attention. I think they do probably within your institution, but this is a tremendous stress on parents. Obviously, fortunately at St. Jude's, they don't have quite the financial stress, but in other institutions, there are going to be a lot of financial stresses of having a child that's this ill. But there are also emotional stresses. And siblings, I think, in particular, the healthy siblings of pediatric cancer patients often get overlooked during this period when so much attention is focused on the child. How do you incorporate them into your programs?
Yeah, so that is so important, and including everybody who's listening who does know somebody with cancer, that this is your plug to spend a little extra time, not just sending fun things to somebody in the hospital, but to the other kids and other people at home. They are a huge part of the team. In non-COVID times, we have sibling support groups. They're virtual now, but with younger patients and younger kids, it's easier to do in person. We do make a huge emphasis on siblings for survivor days, too. So it's not just about the patient, but their whole family as an entire unit. And the parents, I mean, divorce rates are high. This is a stressful time. Sadly, patients often also die and don't make it through therapy, and the stress on a family is tremendous. So we really look at that, treating the family, not just the patient. And that takes time. It's sitting with them, getting to know, okay, we talked about their treatment and what meds they need today. What do you need? How are you? Are you sleeping? How is your relationship? Your significant other is not here today. Where are they? Is everybody okay? Because even when we can support and pay for some part of therapy, which does definitely help, people are still losing their jobs, their careers, what they've worked their whole lives for, to be here at the bedside and care for their children. So, yes. And that's another plug for Make-A-Wish. So Make-A-Wish is a wonderful foundation who grants wishes and very fun trips and things to patients when they're done with therapy. But it's not just the patient. That's a whole family. So we try to use those little things as well to say, okay, when you're done, go on a trip. Do your Make-A-Wish trip for everybody, not just for your sake, for the parents, for the other siblings, to really celebrate what they all went through. Because you're right, it's incredibly important.
And then helping children, the patients, really to get back into normal life, which must be a transition.
It's actually a really hard transition sometimes, because you go from being a sick kid to trying to be normal again.
And getting all of that attention and all of that support.
That, and you know, when everybody says you're okay, but are you still up worried at night that it's going to come back? Even when we said it's okay, how do you relax and just live and not worry? And our teens struggle with that a lot. The younger the kid, the more blissfully unaware they are. But the older they are, the more they're worried, okay, I feel this thing. I don't feel good today. Is it back? And so our psychology and psychiatry piece is paramount to their success, not just during therapy, but after.
And I imagine, and just we're almost ready to close, but being at St. Jude, there may be also some spiritual counseling along the way. And we're going to talk in a future show in the next couple of weeks about spirituality and medicine.
Yes.
I want to thank our two guests. They have been absolutely wonderful, Dr. Floraj and Dr. Talur. They're on the front lines, but all of us can take part in helping these children recover and heal. So,
absolutely.
Thank you, and please be kind to yourselves out there, be kind to others, and talk to you next week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Care Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, brought to you in part by Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com. Employee owned and locally committed. Northfield Pharmacy. Pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. NorthfieldPharmacy.com.
The music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.